大家好，欢迎回到环保 Lover 会客室，我是 Kitty。 我们今天请到这位重量级的国际级嘉宾，他就是政府间气候变化专门委员会第二工作组联合主席 Professor Deborah Roberts。 所以呢，今天这一集是要转 channel 做英文了。 So welcome to our podcast. Today we are thrilled to have Professor Deborah Roberts, a leading figure in global climate policy. She has over 30 years of experience in biodiversity planning, climate change adaptation and sustainable development. Professor Roberts was the firstChief Resilience Officer of the City of Durban and co-chair the IPCC's AR6 Working Group 2, also recognized as one of the world's 100 most influential people in climate policy. So can you elaborate on the role of the IPCC and its impact on shaping global climate policies?
So in the late 80s, what was happening, there was a lot of climate science being done and people began to be quite worried about how the changing climate would impact on our development, our ability to live safe and healthy lives. But the policymakers are so busy, they don't have time to go out and read a lot of scientific papers. So what they did through the United Nations is establish the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And the role of that panel is to provide global policymakers at all scales, but predominantly at the national level, with an objective source of information around climate change. What causes it? Mm-hmm. What are its impacts and how we might respond to it? So it was really set up as a service organization to help policymakers and practitioners understand climate change science, what its impacts would be across a variety of sectors and how they might respond to it. And the way it works is it produces reports. Every 5 to 7 years, you'll see that the IPCC produces a group of reports, either special reports, which are focused on an area of specific policy interest, or global assessment reports that enable the policy environment to have discussions around international climate change policy, to develop national and local policy. So that's really, it bridges the gap between science and policy and practice.
So how would you explain the key concept of climate change and its impacts, particularly in urban areas like Hong Kong?
So the easiest way to describe climate change is because of our activities and the industrial revolution that the world has gone through, we've used a lot of fossil fuels. So we've used oil and we use coal and we use gas. And effectively, by using those materials, we create a gas called carbon dioxide. That goes into the atmosphere. And what that does is it forms like a very thick blanket around the Earth that traps the heat and makes the Earth warmer. And now the problem with carbon dioxide is it can stay in the atmosphere for several hundred, maybe even thousands of years. And so effectively what's happened is we've put a very thick and thickening blanket around the Earth and it's getting warmer. Contributing to that too is the fact that we've also been clearing natural vegetation, which is a great store of carbon. So usually the natural vegetation would suck the carbon out of the atmosphere through the process of photosynthesis, but we're clearing forests and wetlands and grasslands, so that's also releasing carbon as well. So the Earth is heating, and the challenge for us is our entire development path and civilization has grown up in a period of very stable climate on the planet. So about 11,000 years ago, the last ice age ended, the last glacial period, and we moved into the stable warm period, which allowed us to begin to cultivate crops, it allowed us to keep livestock, it allowed us to start building cities, and with cities came the ability to develop civilization and pass on knowledge. So we, our entire civilization, our industry, our farming are all linked to this very stable warm climate that we've been in, and unfortunately because we're now heating the Earth, it's destabilizing the Earth. So we're experiencing more extreme events. They're becoming more frequent. It's becoming harder to grow those crops. Our cities are experiencing extreme heat, which is impacting our infrastructure, experiencing more floods. We see the fires in Los Angeles at the moment. So it's destabilizing the very stable climate that our civilization has evolved in. And that's the real challenge for us, is it's now putting enormous pressure on our society, on our economy, which is making it very difficult for us to manage.
And so what is the latest stage of us right now in terms of climate change?
Yeah, so we're at a very tough stage because the way The IPCC science is used at the end of every year. About 200 governments come together in meetings we refer to as Conference of the Parties or COPs to negotiate international climate policy. And probably the most important of those meetings happened in 2015 in Paris. And there we agreed as a global society, so as a societal compact, we came together and we said, because of the destabilization we're experiencing, we must try and limit global warming to well below 2 degrees. So we don't want the Earth to be more than 2 degrees warmer than it was before the Industrial Revolution. But ideally, because many people are poor and vulnerable, we want to try and keep that towards 1.5. So that's a bit of an aspirational element in the Paris Agreement. The unfortunate thing is to achieve that, we've got to stop burning those fossil fuels, the things that create the carbon dioxide, that create the very thick warming atmosphere around that, and we haven't acted ambitiously enough on that. So the latest science, and in fact, just this last Friday, Copernicus, which is the climate service of the European Union, backed up by the World Meteorological Organization, the WMO, announced that 2024 was the warmest year on record. 2023 was not as hot, but certainly in that realm. And for the first time in a year, we passed that aspirational element of 1.5 degrees of global warming. So why is that significant? It's significant because the science has shown us that when we cross 1.5, the world begins to experience irreversible change. So we've only crossed it for one calendar year now, but it does suggest a trend and that we might not meet that goal. And that goal, we will measure 1.5 over an average of 20 years. So we've got 1 year in the bag. So that suggests we're going to move into a time of increased stress, increased frequency and intensity of extreme events. And all the indications are we're not going to move fast enough to stop us crossing those key goals. And so we will put at risk the important biodiversity that we depend on to thrive and survive and that underpins our economies. It's possible that some areas of the world may become very difficult to live in. It may simply become too hot outside to work, to have livestock outside. It will change rainfall patterns. It will increase the frequency of extreme events. And I don't know, Hong Kong, you know, just the discussions we've been having while I've been here, already knows what those extreme events are like. The extreme rainfall and flooding, that's going to become more frequent. And so we are entering into an era now where we have to think more purposefully how we manage these ongoing crises and how we ensure that in managing those, we are treating people equally. So we need to think particularly about the poor and vulnerable in the world because they are going to be most affected. So we're setting up a very challenging time in the future for ourselves.
Since this time, you are in Hong Kong for a Nature-Based Solution Conference organized by TNC and Civic Exchange. So what do you think in the future, the role that the Nature-Based Solution can play in terms of climate adaptation?
If we look at the current science, the use of our ecosystems to reduce risk, to reduce temperatures, to reduce the peaks of flood, we know that using nature is very important. So nature-based adaptation, nature-based solutions, ecosystem-based adaptation are really important responses to the current level of risk. And so that makes us think in new ways about how we plan and manage cities. We've got to integrate green and blue areas more effectively into our cities. As the risk increases, we'll probably have to increase the blue and green expanse. The challenge will come, though, as the world warms, because the current science suggests that not only will we cross 1.5, we could cross 2, we may even reach 3. We know that some of these ecosystems, so things like the coastal wetlands, the mangroves, the warm water corals, the rainforest, the mountain and polar ecosystems, they will become further at risk, more vulnerable, and could go extinct. So while nature-based solutions are incredibly valuable to us now, we need to think more carefully about how we manage nature going into the future, because it will be at greater risk. And think about where those ecosystems may, in fact, no longer be viable in a greatly warmed world, and what that would mean. So, for example, one of the big responses in coastal areas around the world is for communities to plant out mangroves, because that reduces the kind of storm surge you get from storms and helps manage sea level rise. But if the mangroves can't survive in a changed climate, what do we do then? So there are new and difficult questions we need to be thinking about, which should encourage us to really try and reduce the level of greenhouse gases going into the atmosphere so we minimize the loss of the nature-based solutions, because they are the most resilient, you know, they're the most cost-effective, they create well-being, particularly in our urban areas. And so I think there's a real, we're sending up an urgent flare that now is the time to be working across a number of fronts, you know, really ambitious mitigation, using nature to help us adapt, but also thinking about this future where some of those services from nature may no longer be available to us.
So what kind of advice will you give to a young climate advocates for the climate mitigation? What can they do?
So there's a number of things or roles that I believe the youth can play. The first is helping raise awareness around the need to tackle climate change. And in fact, it's a global experience. If you educate the youth in a household, that helps educate the parents. And if you educate the parents, you can influence the decision makers.
The grandparents.
The grandparents, absolutely. So I think, you know, the ability to raise societal awareness, and I mean the access to social media now means that can be used for good, to spread messages, to increase awareness of this. I also think it's very important for youth to engage leadership and to talk to them about, you know, their aspirations for the future. So I think that's an important level of community engagement. But you can also get very involved at the grassroots level, you know. So I've seen in cities around the world where youth clubs come together because they recognize the importance of nature in their cities. And they take ownership of particular areas. You know, they help manage it. They help clear alien invasive plants. They help restoration work in those particular areas. So it's a kind of learning by doing example. So I think there are a number of things. Raising awareness, you know, raising your concerns within your sphere of influence, be that family or decision makers in your cities or in your rural areas, but also getting involved in your community. You know, where are your natural areas? And if they don't exist, you know, I've seen some things in my own city where youth have gone out and done guerrilla gardening, where they've just taken over wasteland and there was nothing there, and they've planted gardens as a statement of the fact that we want the city to be in a different area. So, I mean, I think there's, you know, a lot of need for the youth to be engaged. I mean, it's a challenging future. You know, I'm always very clear, we shouldn't hide the reality. I think there's a very radical reality out there. But once you understand the challenges we've got, it means that we've got to work harder. We've got to find purpose in the challenge. And the first place to do that is in your local community. You know, how can you change that? Can you plant up a sidewalk? You know, if you've got a garden or even a balcony, you know, you can put plants that attract butterflies and insects in your particular area. So there are a number of things that we need to do to change the nature of where we live, to take on board these risks and help manage them. Because the science is really clear. You know, when we produced the reports of the sixth assessment cycle, we said the only way forward is really transformative change. And you only get transformative change as every single person. So there isn't a single person in the world, not a single family, not a single village or city or country that can sit the stance out. Everyone has to be involved. So we all have to find our individual role in it. And, you know, you'll see some people at the international level, they'll be very prominent, but that work is not more important than local level work done by an individual. All of it adds up towards this kind of transformative change that we need now.
So for you, being a climate scientist, you always look at the bad news, right? The numbers. And how do you stay positive and keep going?
Well, for me, and you know, a lot of people have asked me that question, how do you stay hopeful when all the numbers indicate that we won't make the climate goals, that we need to stop preparing for a time where we exceed our goals in biodiversity, in climate change? And for me, the message is, as the risk is higher, it means you've simply got to work harder. You've got to find greater purpose, you know, because for me, it's an even stronger call to action. If we were meeting all of these goals, then it would be fine. You know, we could have a more relaxed life. But for me, it's a really strong call to action to work even harder, because the hurdles we have to cross are even higher now. And so for me, I take strength from the fact that working hard at least keeps momentum running. It keeps awareness being raised. It keeps action happening. And I reckon as long as we're putting one foot in front of the other, that's an important level of momentum to sustain. Because people get discouraged, you know, if they see people are just saying, well, I can't manage anymore. I'm just going to sit here and do nothing. It doesn't encourage them to remain active. And so I think if we all find purpose in the challenge we will undoubtedly face, it gives us a greater chance of keeping response options on the table and finding new solutions, because we'll all keep investigating, doing things, trying new approaches, which I think will be important at this point.
Yeah, you don't take any holidays, right?
No, but that's not a model to follow. I mean, that's unsustainable. But I think it's a call to action. It's about hard and continuous work, you know, realizing that the mountain we have to climb is even steeper and higher now, which means there has to be greater purpose in our attempts to get up that mountain.
So since you have been in Hong Kong, or you are in Hong Kong right now, so what kind of advice, like one advice for Hong Kong people to change, what would it be?
So, I mean, Hong Kong is a very impressive city. It's a world city. It's a global city. So, you know, I think residents of Hong Kong should be very proud of their city. But I think it's important to think about the future of Hong Kong and the development trajectory of Hong Kong. You know, we've had the opportunity here to talk about the Northern Metropolis, and I think there's an opportunity there to learn the lessons from Hong Kong to really create probably a global leading lesson around what the city of the 21st century, which has to deal with all of these challenges, really should look like. You know, really greater use of blue-green infrastructure, more creative ways of urban design. And so I think it's important for the people of Hong Kong to be involved in discussions around the development of their region, because there's a certain quality of life here you do want to protect. And I think that could be materialized in a more effective way by people being involved and participating in the kind of discussions around future development, but also working with authorities. I mean, we heard in discussions today around moves towards improved early warning systems, and there stakeholder engagement is really important, because if you're going to mobilize around some of these riskier events, you need communities to be working in partnership with government. So forming those partnerships, you know, where can I be involved? Where can I support government work? Where can I add my voice to the development aspirations of the city? Getting out, enjoying the greenery. You know, are you hiking every weekend and enjoying this? Because if you enjoy these green and natural areas, you'll be more inclined to defend them and become involved in their management. So for me, it's important for urban residents to re-engage with their cities, to be a real part of visioning the cities, managing, contributing to the debate around our cities, because we're long past a scenario where government by itself can manage the world's cities in this new phase. We're all going to have to be a part of that conversation.
I feel like I can chat with Professor Roberts forever, you know. But we only have one question left. So what is your vision for 2050?
My vision, and one doesn't want to be a doomsayer, but I just, you know, I'm a realist. I draw from the science, and the science is indicating we, by 2050, will live in a much more dangerous and risky world, with more extreme events, more frequent extreme events, a hotter world. So for me, I see a future, certainly over the next couple of decades, where in fact it gets tougher to deal with these challenges. But I'm hoping that as we move into that difficult period, that valuable lessons will be learnt from not having met our original goals, that will make us more ambitious to not only correct the wrongs of the past, but to inspire us to think more innovatively and out of the box about how we don't repeat those mistakes again, how we move forward. Because, you know, many young people came to me and say, oh, we're not going to meet the goals. You know, what will happen in 2030? I can reassure you the world is not going to end. You know, that we will continue. But the fact is, I think we need to be braver, more innovative, more courageous about the way we change our society, the way we relate to each other. So I'm hoping it'll drive us to a safer world, a more equitable world, a world where there's more empathy amongst nation states, and that we really find the ability through working together on these risks, you know, to form greater partnerships at the global level. Because very often, a situation of risk forces us to work together. And I think we might learn valuable lessons then. So I see a riskier future, but I'm thinking it might be the crucible that really forges us into a global society that learns to respect each other, work together, value each other, and be more empathetic with one another going forward. So I'm hopeful on that score.
Great. Yeah, we should all be hopeful and get back to work.
Absolutely. That's the message, Katie, is we've all got to be working really hard. If anyone takes home a message, get back to work.
Yeah, get back to work. Okay, so I have learned so much these few days, actually, being with Deborah, Professor Roberts. I really, truly thank you. Yeah. I feel really thankful because you answer a lot of questions that I have on my mind all the time. So, yeah, thank you so much. And so for you guys, if you guys like this episode, remember to like, share, comment, save, subscribe our channel. And so see you next time. Bye. Thank you so much.
Excellent.